hopefully everybody can hear me. I really appreciate our guests joining us tonight and everybody joining the call. My name is Jeff Huebner. I'm a family physician in Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm chair of the NPA Policy Committee, and I'm going to be helping host and moderate the phone call tonight with our guest, Dr. Garen Wintemute. So let me just introduce our speaker. Dr. Wintemute is the inaugural Baker Tarrant Chair in Violence Prevention and Director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the University of California, Davis. He practices and teaches emergency medicine at UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento, which is a Level 1 regional trauma center. He is also professor of emergency medicine there. His recent perspective piece, Tragedy's Legacy, appeared in the December 26th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, is what I have. I was just looking at that, and it said January, so I'm not sure. But anyway, his research focuses on the nature and prevention of violence and on the development of effective violence prevention measures and policies. He is the author of two books, Ring of Fire, Study of the Handgun Makers of Southern California, and Inside Gun Shows, What Goes On When Everybody Thinks Nobody's Watching. His work has been supported by the California and U.S. Departments of Justice, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and many private foundations. He has testified frequently before committees of Congress and state and local legislatures as an expert on firearm violence and its prevention. And in 1997, he was named a Hero of Medicine by Time magazine. He received his bachelor's degree from Yale and attended medical school and residency at UC Davis and received his MPH at Johns Hopkins. Without further ado, Dr. Garen Wintemute.
Thanks, Jeff. Hello, everybody. Good evening. You get bonus points for continuing work after the working hours. It was lots of fun listening to people sign in. You're from all over the country. And it's very gratifying to be here. My guess was that if not before, certainly in the last 6 weeks or so, everybody has spent a great deal of time thinking about the problem of firearm violence and listening to other people talk about it on TV, on the internet, and so on. And you probably would like a chance to talk about it yourselves, or at least get some questions answered. So, and I've also been told that you guys are not beginners in this topic, and that's great. So we're not going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to keep my remarks short. So I would recommend starting now to draft those emails to Jeff. I will not be talking for very long. I think this will be much more fun for you. It will probably be much more fun for me if it's and much more productive all around if it's based on your questions and comments. So get them rolling. What I'm going to do, excuse me, is sort of set the whole topic by briefly reviewing four myths that are pervasive, at least among the public, and I think hinder efforts to prevent firearm violence. I will briefly touch on some policy recommendations that have been made and the rationale for them, and then open it up. So, to the myths. The first one is that rates of firearm violence are decreasing. This statement appears frequently, including in government publications, and it's simply not true. The comparison is often made between the present and 1994, which is when rates of violence peaked. And if we just look at those two data points, rates are lower now than they were then. But all the decrease occurred between 1994 and 2000 or 2001. And if you think of firearm violence in aggregate, and I'm just going to talk fatalities here, if you think of homicide and suicide together, the rate of fatal firearm violence since about 2001 has been absolutely steady. If you plot it, it's as horizontal. You could float a bubble in a level on it. It's absolutely horizontal and straight as a ruler. It's almost eerie. The last 3 or 4 years, there's been a slight decline on a national average basis, and we have to remember that National averages are a fiction. Violence is local. A slight decline on a national average basis in homicide, which has been completely offset by an increase in suicide. If we look at rates of firearm-related crime, the best source of that is probably the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is a big part of what the census takers do when they're not taking the census every 10 years. It's a huge enterprise. And according to the NCVS, rates of firearm-related violent crime are actually up, again, on a national basis, 25% in the last 3 or 4 years. No one knows how to reconcile the disparity between fatality and crime. I don't think we can give credit to better medical care. It just hangs out there. But it simply is not the case that there's been a continuing decline in rates of firearm violence. And I would argue, and I suspect everybody on the call would agree, whether it's going down or not, it's unacceptably high, and we can't be complacent. Myth number two, criminals can't buy guns. Let me amend that. Myth number two, criminals can't legally buy guns. It's understood that there are people who will purchase firearms illegally, but the myth lies in the drawing of some sort of bright line between felons and others who are prohibited by law from buying guns and all the rest of, quote, us, unquote, who are law-abiding gun owners. And that's simply not reflective of the facts of the situation. Just for the sake of clarity, I'm going to define a law-abiding gun owner, a law-abiding anybody, as somebody who has no criminal record, somebody who's never been arrested. That's an extreme definition, but let me hang on to it just for a second. In the middle is a huge group of people that I call not-so-law-abiding gun owners, in this case, and it is simply the fact that, at least under federal law, while a person who's a felon cannot buy a gun, a person who has been convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor cannot buy a gun, a person can have a very extensive record of convictions for violent crime, as long as those crimes are misdemeanors, and still buy as many guns as the law otherwise allows. So just to highlight one disparity, under federal law, if I am convicted of misdemeanor violent crime involving my partner, I'm prohibited for life. But I can punch my next-door neighbor. I can punch next-door neighbors for years. And as long as I'm only convicted of misdemeanors, I can buy as many guns as I want under federal law. California, where I live and work, and other states have gone further, and we'll talk about that. But it simply is not the case that our legal structure prevents criminals as intuitively defined by the public, or to be a little bit more precise, people who are members of classes that are demonstrably at very much increased risk for committing criminal violence from buying guns. There's much work that we can do here. Myth number three, there are too many guns in the United States and we can't do a thing about it, about violence. Nobody knows for sure, we all have sort of coalesced around a number, which people do from time to time. There are somewhere between 250 and 300 million firearms in civilian hands in the United States. We really don't know for sure how many they are. There have been some surveys done, and people cobble up estimates of the national prevalence of ownership in firearms based on surveys of, say, 1,500 people. And we know what that estimate is as of a given point in time, and we sort of add to that the number of guns sold every year. Nobody tries to model for attrition, for disappearance of guns from the population, because nobody knows the rate at which that happens. But frankly, between 250 million and 300 million, I don't care. It's a lot of guns. Put it in perspective this way. We have less than 5% of the world's population. We control more than 40% of the firearms that are in civilian hands. We have a lot of guns. But it's been known since the mid-70s that new guns, guns that are, as research has come better to define it, 3 years of age or less, are far more likely to be used in crime than are older guns. And it turns out that some very large percentage of that huge number of guns is stored away in the attic or locked away in a safe or in some way removed from active circulation and not part of the day-to-day problem that we all, as clinicians and citizens, deal with. And it's been empirically shown over and over and over again that one can interfere with criminal commerce in new guns and do good things about rates of violence without disturbing the vast majority of guns that are lying, if you will, dormant in somebody's home or have simply disappeared and nobody has subtracted them from the calculation. And the final myth I'll mention is that opposition to prevention efforts is insurmountable. There has long been, there still is for many people, a belief that organizations like the National Rifle Association can call the shots, that they can determine the outcome of elections more or less at will. And it turns out that that's simply not true. There's been some very careful analysis done by academics and reported by the Center for American Progress showing that the National Rifle Association simply does not have the power that it has. In fact, in some cases, they have been used as, I've tried to think of what the term might be, but I'm going to call it a scapegoat. It's not quite accurate in this case. They've been given credit for determining the outcomes of elections by the people who lost those elections when, in fact, it was more the responsibility of the people who lost. But it's easier to give credit to the NRA, and that's been done more than once, including by losing presidential candidates more than once. It turns out simply not to be true, as I mentioned. And another point to make on that, with regard to that myth, is this. It's become increasingly clear as polling has been done with greater and greater frequency in recent years that the positions taken by the National Rifle Association as an organization, as articulated by its leadership and its public affairs staff, do not reflect the priorities of their own membership. In fact, it's one of the great ironies of this, as we've learned much more about it, that gun policy in the United States is less oriented toward regulation than would be reflected in the priorities of the majority of gun owners, let alone the general population. And I'll give you some specifics about that in just a second. It's more the case that gun policy in the United States reflects the wishes, the priorities of a relatively radical fringe among gun owners. So those are the myths. Let me briefly touch on some of the leading policy proposals and the reasons behind them, and then I'm going to shut up and we'll start doing Q&A. First, background checks. This is something I've worked on a great deal. The proposal that is before Congress, more or less, is to require that all transfers of firearms go through licensed retailers so that a background check is always conducted and a permanent record is kept. This has several distinct major advantages, and I think from a violence prevention point of view is probably the most important thing on the table, and it has been very heartening to see opinion coalesce around this being something that can be done. Nationwide, something like 40% of all... Actually, I'm sorry, let me start at a separate spot. If I go to buy a gun from a licensed retailer, I have to show identification. I have to fill out a fairly complicated multi-page form and certify that I'm not a prohibited person. These days, the background check is run on me to verify that I'm telling the truth, and I might have to wait 3 days to acquire that gun for the background check to be completed if it can't be completed right away. And a permanent record is kept in case that gun is later used in a crime and law enforcement needs to trace its ownership. Excuse me, glass of water. But nationwide, on average, something like 40% of all firearm transfers and at an absolute minimum 80% of transfers that are done with criminal intent involve only private parties. There's no need to show identification. There's no background check. There's no waiting period. There's no record. These transfers are completely anonymous and undocumented. Now, I might be that law-abiding gun owner I mentioned before, somebody with no arrest record for whom all of this is simply a convenience. But the country still suffers because there's no record of the purchase in case later the gun is used in a crime. But if I'm acquiring that gun with criminal intent, even if I'm not a prohibited person, this is really advantageous for me because there's no record and the gun can't be linked to me. If I am a prohibited person, if I'm a felon, or a domestic violence misdemeanant or a narcotics addict, let's say, the government knows that I'm a narcotics addict, which is another question. It's the only option for me because the background check will either smoke me out, and I could conceivably be prosecuted for a felony for even trying to purchase the gun. So I go to a private party if I'm a prohibited person and I want a gun. And the icing on the cake for this is this. If I'm a prohibited person and I buy a gun, I've committed a crime. But if I'm the private party seller of that gun, under federal law, I have only committed a crime in selling the gun to the prohibited person if I, to use the exact language, know or have reasonable cause to believe that that's what I've done. And you can see the obvious way in which all this gets finessed, and I've watched it happen and photographed it happening hundreds of times. The purchaser simply doesn't ask the questions, the seller simply doesn't ask the questions, and the purchaser obviously is savvy enough not to volunteer the answers, and that's how it works. We talk about gun shows in this context because gun shows are where you can see it all happen. But it's a much, much larger problem than gun shows, and closing the gun show loophole, if that were all we did, would be a waste of time. These transactions happen everywhere. They happen in particular, and I suspect increasingly on the Internet, which may actually make gun shows partially obsolete. So it will matter to bring all transfers of firearms under that regulatory structure, simply because it will help prevent prohibited persons and those who want to buy guns anonymously because they're going to do crime with them, or they're supplying guns to other people who do crime with them, from acquiring those guns. And the other advantage it has is that if there's a record of every transfer, if that gun is later used in a crime, it's easier to reconstruct its chain of ownership and try and identify a gun trafficking pathway, which is a very common way by which guns end up in the hands of criminal end users. So I'm a big supporter of a measure to require background checks for all sales. In fact, our organization will be issuing a big report on this probably week after next. I should add that these systems are not talked about just hypothetically. We've been doing it this way in California for more than 20 years. We sell 600,000 guns a year in this state, more than that last year. We just don't have the data. And it works. Everybody pretty much has accustomed themselves to the system. When illegal activity is suspected, it's easier to find. The retailers help find it, actually, because they have an interest in keeping the business clean. The system works. I'm going to mention just one other, I think, frankly, and then I'm going to stop and open it up, and if there aren't questions or comments, I'll pick up, but I've already talked longer than I thought I might. An assault weapons ban. This one's problematic, and I'm sure you've all read about it. Let me briefly sketch some history. This is something that has not been part of the discussion. We are at present stuck again with the problem of how do you define what's an assault weapon and distinguish those weapons from others that are functionally identical but look different. Here's the history. ATF, for a very long time, has had the authority to ban the importation of guns that are not particularly suitable for sporting purposes, to use the exact language. That's from the Gun Control Act of 1968. And at that time, the language was put in statute with the intent to have ATF outlaw the importation of what we all have come to call Saturday night specials. And the language, there was nothing further. ATF tried to figure out what to do about sporting purposes. And they came up with a series of design features that identified Saturday night specials, and they outlawed their importation. At the time, there was no domestic manufacturer of these guns because they could be made more cheaply overseas and shipped. A side story. Within a year, there was a very robust American industry making cheap guns. That segment of the industry has since disappeared, but at one time in the mid-90s when firearm violence was peaking in this country, the number one, the number three, and the number five makers of semi-automatic pistols in the United States made only these guns, and cheap handguns. And the those companies accounted for almost 900,000 guns a year, and they're now gone. But that was the infrastructure that was in place, design standards for imports. So when Patrick Purdy shot up a school about 40 miles south of here, killed four students and a teacher and wounded 30-some others, what was on the table to use at the federal level for reaction was this process of identifying features that made guns not suitable for sporting purposes so that their importation could be banned. Patrick Purdy used an imported AK-47, and all the push was behind, let's ban their importation. And the Bush administration did that, but they had to use that sporting purposes mechanism. So they came up with a bunch of, if you will, cosmetic features that we've all come to know very well. The flash suppressor, the bayonet, the folding stock, and so forth. Recognizing that there were at that time, and there still are today, much, much more so, rifles in particular that had the same working parts as did the weapons that were being banned, but didn't have those cosmetic features. So later, when an assault weapons ban was debated in the early 90s, we were stuck with that sort of approach. And we used it, and it didn't work nearly as well as everybody hoped it might, and a lot of people, me included, were skeptical that it would work at all. Here's what happened. The industry adapted, as industries do, and they first imported and then manufactured domestically, because the ban in 94 applied to domestic weapons as well. They manufactured weapons that had the same functional hardware but looked different. So what we are stuck with today is huge numbers of firearms that accept high-capacity detachable magazines that have the functional working parts, if you will, of the weapons that everybody was interested in doing something about at the beginning, but don't look quite like those weapons anymore. It turns out that assault-type weapons were used in a fairly small percentage of crimes to begin with, absolutely under 10%, probably under 5%, and it was understood at the time the ban was put in place that we would not see a major drop in crime rates as a result because they were rarely used. We might prevent an increase, but you all are familiar with the paradox of prevention. We don't know if we've done that or not. What happened was that banned weapons became much less frequently used in crime, but functionally similar or identical weapons that weren't banned but used the same high-capacity magazines, fired the same ammunition, took their place. And I think that was the common understanding. There's a twist to that. Some very careful work done by the Washington Post and reported first a year or two ago and then updated on January 10th, if anybody wants to track this down, under the byline. The reporter's name is David Fallis. It's F-A-L-L-I-S. Did a very close look at what happened with magazines using data in Virginia. They had cooperative law enforcement there. And, and they were able to show that there was, in fact, a steady decrease in the use of high-capacity magazines in guns recovered in a criminal context in Virginia that reversed itself the moment the ban was lifted and continues to increase as recently as their data go. So I was surprised and really pleased by that. I think, and the people who did the formal evaluation of the assault weapons ban, I think, have agreed that it looks like maybe there was, as the ban was approaching its sunset date in 2004, some evidence that it was working on ammunition capacity, which, after all, is what this was all about. And then the ban sunset, as that was designed in from the beginning. And what we see now today is a resurgence of the use of high-capacity magazines. So the ban on firearms has been reintroduced. We'll see what happens. But there's the potential, and I may be 2 days out of date here, but I've heard rumor anyway, and many of you on the call may know better than I, that legislation has been introduced specifically just to go after the magazines separately from the firearms. And the evidence that we have is that, at least to a modest degree, such an approach works. Here in California today, a group of senators held a press conference regarding a whole raft of legislation that's being introduced, and one of those proposals is a ban on the possession, not just commerce, which is what's happening at the federal level, a ban on the possession of magazines with capacity of greater than 10 rounds. We'll just have to see what happens with that. So, enough monologue for me, I think. There are lots of proposals on the table. There's lots to discuss about why those proposals are there, perhaps, and not others, and whether they might work or not. I'm going to stop now, and Jeff, this is coming back to you with questions or comments from people on the call.
Great. Thanks so much for that amazing presentation, Garen. And the questions are starting to roll in, so let's see what we can have here for some dialogue. I want to remind people, too, that in the email that went out with the call-in information, it included a link to a summary of policy recommendations from the recent two-day summit on gun violence that was held at Johns Hopkins on January 14th and 15th. So you can find a very nice outline of the proposals that have evidence and what the leading national and international experts came up with. So kind of to start us off, I'm going to use moderator's prerogative and throw out the first question. This has been something, you know, our own internal group within of members and leadership that have been active on the issue, especially since December, but generally have been thinking about, and this probably would be a call in and of itself, but I'm going to see if you can just try it for 2 or 3 minutes since we do have other questions. But thinking about what is the balance in advocating for improvements and reforms in mental health, yet that's also used as a red herring by groups like the NRA and some legislators, versus what I see in the summary of the policy recommendations, which is really some specifics about trying to keep high-risk individuals from purchasing guns. If you could kind of provide a little outline on that, I think that'd be great.
Sure. I'm really glad that's come up early. So here are the federal standards. There are two mental health tests, two mental health prohibitions. Problem number one, arguably, is that they're both lifelong. But here are the two tests. One is prohibited if one has been, quote, adjudicated as a mental defective, unquote, or if one has been, quote, committed to a mental institution, unquote. That language is 45 years old now. It reflects an understanding of mental illness that I think is actually far older than that. It's ambiguous. It's offensive. It needs to be changed. It doesn't reflect two things that we knew about mental illness at that time, and we know much, much more accurately now than we did then. One is that mental illness is not a forever unchangeable kind of thing, and I will leave that to experts to discuss more in detail. But we also know this. Actually, I probably ought to add it to the list of myths. Serious mental illness by itself is associated with an increased risk of violence that is either too small reliably to detect or not present at all. There have been a number now of a of large cohort studies, different methods, different populations, different parts of the country, some of which have concluded there is no increase in risk associated with the illness itself, or that there is an increase that's really quite small. What we do have is that among people who are seriously mentally ill, and the definition of that phrase varies from study to study, a prior history of violence or threats of violence is associated with a substantially increased risk of violence in the future. A prior history, prior or current history of alcohol or other substance abuse is associated with a substantially increased risk of violence in the future. But those two risk factors apply to everyone, not just those with serious mental illness, which, a digression, raises the possibility that maybe part of the way to go after mental illness is to go after alcohol, but I'll come back to that maybe. And the third one, and I think there's probably less clarity about this, but there's consensus, I believe, is that it's also clearly a risk factor if one has not only serious mental illness, but has been prescribed medicines and is not taking them. Question is, does that reflect that the medicines aren't working, or does it reflect the state of mind of the person who's not taking them? So that's where we sit. Those facts about mental illness are simply not addressed in the current federal criteria. States have gone further. I only know about California, and I will. And there's an ER doc. I'll tell you briefly how it works here. When somebody is put on what we call a 5150 hold, it's the acute danger to others, danger to self, or grave disability hold, and the number comes from a section of our state welfare and institutions code. When they're just in our emergency department waiting, that's not a reportable event. But when they are admitted to a licensed mental health facility for 72-hour diagnostic evaluation, that is a reportable and prohibiting offense under state law, reflecting the fact that if I just threatened to kill myself or kill somebody else, I'm at increased risk for doing that. But the prohibition is temporary. It's 5 years. At the end of that 72-hour period, I am then involving a different level of decision-making, held for up to 14 days of no longer observation but inpatient treatment, that's a federally reported event, and the prohibition is lifelong. But what we've done is lower the bar, but make the prohibition at that lowered level temporary, which I think much more accurately reflects the dynamics of mental illness.
Thanks for that. Next question is, if you could review the current state of research on reducing gun violence or the lack thereof, and what the president's executive order means for restoring the research, is this enough, or do we still need Congress to appropriate more funding to the CDC, for instance, to actually carry out new research?
Good. I'm very happy for the second half of that question. I heard review research on gun violence. Oh, my gosh, how many days do we have? So I understand. No, the executive order is not enough. There are, taking all disciplines together, everything from clinical medicine to criminology and everything in between, economics, public health, you can count up the number of people who focus on firearm violence as their major research commitment on the fingers of two hands and have fingers left over. It's really remarkable. Here is a problem that causes 30,000 deaths a year, double or triple that number of serious injuries, alters the pattern of life of entire communities, and we've got less than a dozen people, less than 10 people working on it, our top people. Very nice. There is in this country one person, precisely one person, still working, who has firsthand experience evaluating the impact of an assault weapons ban anywhere. One guy. How crazy is that? So at CDC, there are a whole bunch of smart epidemiologists and other researchers who have just been ordered to do research on firearm violence. But to my knowledge, and I don't think I'm overlooking anybody, there's no one at that agency who has done more than occasional work in this topic for a decade. So we lack two things right now. At a time when the nation has finally awakened to the fact that this is a crisis, that we are, to overdramatize just slightly, under armed attack. We are losing 30,000 people a year to this. We don't have the data, the evidence that we need in order to formulate an optimal response, and we don't have the labor force that we need in order to get that information quickly. We are behind the curve, and we need to tool up. So the president has ordered CDC to begin research, and they'll do that, but there's no money available for CDC. They're going to have to take money from other programs if they're going to ramp this up, and CDC, I don't think, wastes money. I think that's very unfortunate. There's been no discussion that I'm a party to of CDC supporting research done by others. That money will have to come from Congress, and most specifically, it will have to come through the House of Representatives. I don't think it has a good chance. Now, separately, the National Institute of Justice, which had its own program because of the tenacity of one person, a woman who weighs about 90 pounds, by the name of Lois Mock, who was program officer. You know, Lois was a diminutive person, but she did not mess with Lois. She fought and kept that program, a program of research going at the National Institute of Justice until she retired about 5 years ago. Program died the moment she retired. NIJ just last week, actually just this week, issued a solicitation for research on firearm violence. So the feds are back in the game, but not nearly enough. Private foundations took up a lot of the slack when CDC was forced off the field in the mid-90s, but they too have moved on to other things, partly because there are other big problems. There's global warming, there's the healthcare system, et cetera, and partly because they recognized that policymakers weren't going to do anything with evidence that was gathered, so let's put our money elsewhere. I think all that's going to change, but so far there's been a lot of hopeful talk. I think there just hasn't been time enough to see a funding stream open up.
Still there, Garen?
I'm still here.
Oh, good. Maybe I cut off there. Just didn't hear the very last few words that you said. So the next question I have here is, what are your thoughts about whether it would be better to work, this is from Michael Williams, who's on the call, would it be better to work for gun violence at a federal level or gun violence prevention at a federal level, or is there still value in working at the state level despite the whole issue of movement of guns across state lines and things of that nature?
Yes. Thanks for that question. That's really perceptive. We need to do both. We need to act at the federal level because some solutions really only work optimally if they're implemented nationwide. And background checks are a good example. California, as I mentioned before, we've had background checks for all gun purchases, and it works here. But we are next door to Nevada and Arizona, and they don't. And I have gone to gun shows in Reno, which is the big city in Nevada closest to us, and almost a third of the cars in the parking lot are from California. Which is just one way of emphasizing the point. We're all aware of well-trodden pathways by which guns go from, let's say, the Southeast to the Middle Atlantic in New England, or from the Deep South, Mississippi in particular, to places like Chicago and Wisconsin, Madison, Jeff, where you are. So we need to raise the floor. We need more rigorous federal regulation. At the same time, we need to recognize, as Justice Louis Brandeis did many, many years ago, that the states serve as the laboratories of democracy here. He meant that as an absolute compliment, and I think he was right. California's been a really good example. Maryland and Massachusetts also. States need to be free to, if you will, conduct policy experiments to respond to the changes that they see and implement innovations, some of which will turn out to be really good ideas and will be replicated. Others will turn out to be really bad ideas and will will die aborning. Others will turn out to be really bad ideas and get replicated nonetheless. And the one that comes to mind for me, I think, is the Stand Your Ground laws, which originated in Florida, and I don't need to explain to this group what those are. I have come away, I'm a real believer in this whole laboratory of democracy concept, but I look in particular at what comes out of Florida. I think, you know, sometimes it seems that Dr. Frankenstein has been running the lab. But I think, to come back to Mike's question, I think we need to do both.
I won't make any comments about what's happening here in Wisconsin right now either. So I have a couple questions regarding some of the technology issues, and not being an expert myself, I'll try to combine these into one question, but see where you want to go with this. What about gun safety devices like trigger locks and chamber indicators? Is there evidence for whether they are effective in preventing gun deaths? And then I have another one about micro-stamping technology of guns.
Yep. Okay. I'll take them in order. A loaded chamber indicator, for those who might not be familiar with the term, is some sort of feature of a semi-automatic pistol, or it could be done on a rifle, I suppose, but we're talking about pistols, that tells the person holding the gun that there's a round in the chamber, that the gun can be fired. There are lots of case reports of people being shot and killed because the person holding the gun has removed the magazine from the gun, or for whatever reason believes that there's not a, a round in the chamber, and they're wrong. And the wrong way to find out is to fire the gun and kill somebody with it. That's a technology that has been around for more than a century. The Colt 45 pistol, the sort of iconic sidearm that our military has used for a long time. It's called the Model 1911, and that's when it first, in big numbers, hit the military. That gun had a loaded chamber indicator initially at the insistence of the military. It's been around for a long time, but it was taken out later. Gun locks, I don't think, need an explanation. On an anecdotal basis, and there have been some studies, the General Accounting Office did one more than a decade ago, looking at the circumstances involving unintentional shootings and asking the question, if this gun had a loaded chamber indicator, if there had been a gun lock on it, would this shooting have occurred? And in a fair percentage of cases, the answer is no. For example, if there's a lock on the gun, the 4-year-old is not going to get it and shoot the 2-year-old. If there's a loaded chamber indicator, a 4-year-old won't know the difference, but a firearms instructor or any other adult might. And I picked on firearms instructor because there have been cases where they haven't realized the gun was loaded. But we're talking about unintentional shootings here. So it depends. Every shooting is worth preventing. Would loaded chamber indicators and gun locks make a big, obvious difference in the number of people who die from gun violence every year? No. I will make one exception to that, actually, come to think of it. I'm just thinking on the fly. Suicide. Youth suicide most frequently involves weapons that are obtained from home. And if I'm the adult and I'm the gun owner in the home, and I have those guns locked up, and it's a combination lock or of some sort, or the key is not around, because trust me, kids know where the keys are, then the potential that those firearms would be used in a suicide or stolen and used in a homicide is less. I think the solution in the future that might address this problem most effectively is personalizing guns, designing into the gun technology such that it can only be operated by an authorized user. Lots of ways to do that. It's always been just a theoretical conversation, but personalized guns are now on the market in Europe, and they are headed this way, I believe, this year to the United States. Micro-stamping. Micro-stamping refers to technology by which the serial number of the gun is imprinted on the cartridge case of a round of ammunition when that round of ammunition is fired. We're more commonly talking about semi-automatic pistols here than revolvers, and that's okay because semi-autos are a lot more common these days. But the idea here is that if, particularly with street violence, there are lots of cartridge cases lying around afterwards, and if these cartridge cases now have the serial number of the gun on them, that can help solve those crimes. A related proposal is to serialize ammunition itself. Not have the gun apply a serial number when the gun is fired, but ammunition comes out of the box with a serial number on it. Micro-stamping, somebody better correct me if I'm wrong, and can send Jeff an email about this. Micro-stamping legislation has been passed in California. It's been considered elsewhere. I do not believe there is any state that now requires firearms to have micro-stamping incorporated. So it hasn't had a large-scale real-world test yet. But that's where the laboratory of democracy idea comes in. I think it's absolutely worth having that real-world test to see if it's something we should be doing on a larger scale yet.
Okay, I think you addressed this partially before when we were talking about the assault weapons ban versus the high-capacity magazine issue, but another question about should we be focusing in on trying to reduce access to ammunition?
I didn't talk about that, and that's a wonderful idea. It's been talked about for a long time. I think it will get that large-scale real-world test here, probably beginning next year. So here's the thinking behind it. All the conversation has been about guns. We're going to control access to guns and so on. But guns don't kill people. Bullets kill people, if I may borrow the quote. It is useful, perhaps, to think of a gun as a bullet delivery device. And we can control access to and use of the delivery device, or we can control access to and use of that which the device delivers. We have an extensive regulatory structure for firearms. We do not have such a structure for ammunition. So the question comes up, should we control purchasing of ammunition the way we control purchasing of firearms? Never been tried on a large scale, not prospectively. There are cities in California, LA got this started, and others, including Sacramento, where I am, have jumped on the bandwagon, that have required a log be kept of ammunition purchases that purchasers have to show identification and a record is made. They have to leave a thumbprint in some cases. And people have come along after the fact to see if prohibited people are buying ammunition. And lo and behold, they are. And they're even leaving their real identifiers so you can find that out when you come back and look at the logbook. In fact, here in California, the percentage of prohibited people buying ammunition is twice as high as the percentage of people trying to buy firearms. Those people get caught in real time. The ammunition buyers get found out after the fact. What's happening here in Sacramento is there's such a requirement for a log, and the police department comes along afterwards and finds the prohibited people. That's grounds for a search warrant. And when they go to the house to say, hey, why do you, the prohibited person, have this ammunition, it turns out they're also finding lots of guns and lots of controlled substances and so on. And these cases have a very high likelihood of ending in not just the confiscation of all that stuff, but a successful prosecution. So legislation, there actually may be more than one proposal, is being introduced here to set up something like that statewide, either a background check every single time the purchase goes through, as with firearms, or I think that's still just being talked about, or a permitting process such that on some regular interval, somebody who wants to buy ammunition has to get a permit to do that, and then very quickly at the time of purchase, a check is done to see if that permit has been voided.
Thank you. I have a question. I'm curious about your experience that you've had, the experiences you've had so far in being an expert in testifying in front of legislators and other public venues, as far as, you know, the reactions you get from legislators and how you deal with the myths. And again, I know this could be a long answer, but just
kind
of a quick overview.
Yeah, I'll keep it short. I'm glad it came up because I know that that's where this call is headed. The vast majority of legislators, like the vast majority of people, want to hear the facts. They want to do decently in life. They want to make things better for their kids, and at the end, when they die, they want to know that the world is a better place for their having been there. There are people who are exceptions to that rule. Some of them are legislators, but they're the minority. So I have encountered hostile legislators. I don't return that hostility. And wherever I have testified, and I've testified for state legislatures in a number of different states, not just this one, let alone Congress, you take what you get. We all work clinically with people who are difficult, and as a witness, you have the same encounters. I am an enthusiastic proponent of physicians being involved in the legislative process, not just on this issue, because when we as physicians, let me start in a slightly different spot. When we as physicians get involved in that process, and it's about our income or something, people look askance at us, and rightly do they so. But when physicians speak out on behalf of their patients and their communities, we exert a type of moral leadership that almost no other class of people in the United States can call on. And I would very strongly encourage people, even if you're not experts on this topic, to speak from your own experience as citizens and leaders in your community, and the vast majority of people you encounter will receive you well for it.
Well, that's very well said and very inspiring. I'm just checking here to see if any others have rolled in. We are about ready to transition over, but you actually mentioned in your article the tragedies of legacy. So I wonder if that was a quote from somewhere else. You know, this tension comes up between what we can do now versus changing the culture of violence or gun violence. I just wondered if you had a couple thoughts about that.
Yes. When I was writing that on the 14th of December in the evening, I was thinking about the similarities to HIV. I was in practice before HIV showed up and remember what it was like when it was a death sentence. For a very long time, we thought we had to choose, and much of the world this is still true, we had to choose between prevention and treatment, and we learned that, in this country at least, that choice doesn't need to be made. I don't think that choice needs to be made with regard to firearm violence either. We need to do both. We need to do those things that we believe will work now with the situation we have on the ground. 250 to 300 million guns, all of it. There are things that we can do. At the same time, I think and there's more demand for this than there has been in a very long time. I think it's appropriate for us to reconsider our relationship with firearms in the United States. Do we have the kind of relationship that we want? Is it okay with us, and I don't mean us on the call, I mean all of us, is it okay with us that there are places in this country where a person can walk into a bar carrying a gun legally as long as they, quote, don't drink, unquote? Is that what we want? That process is going to take much longer. It may take generations. We can start it now. And while we're engaging in that process, let's do the things that will make a difference today.
Well, I want to speak on behalf of everyone listening on the call for NPA's Gun Violence Task Force and our leadership and extending our gratitude for your time tonight. And I found this call to be very, very informative and enlightening and inspiring. So do you have any last comments you'd like to offer?
Nothing about that. I just I'd like to say thanks for having me. It is it's encouraging beyond words that things like this are happening. And I, like all of us, I'm very sorry that it has taken this latest in a string of awful tragedies to bring the country to its current state of sense of imperative that something has to be done. But we're here, so let's make the most. Let's do everything we can to transmute all that tragedy into a better future.